You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The New York Public Library opened its landmark Beaux-Arts main branch, now known as the Stephen A. Schwarzman Building, 100 years ago. And to mark its centennial, it's put together an exhibition of some of the highlights of its collection called Celebrating 100 Years. It's on view now through December 31st, and I'm pleased to welcome Elaine Charnoff, Director of Education Programming and Exhibitions at the Library, back to our show to tell us about it. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, as I said, the main branch of the library opened in 1911. Did the library exist in other locations before that?
Not in the form that we all think of the New York Public Library. In fact, the creation of what's now the flagship station really originated thanks to three great New Yorkers who were really philanthropists. The Lenox Library, James Lenox, had a private library. John Jacob Astor had a library. And what had been the former New Yorker governor, Samuel Tilden, was really interested in creating a library, but in fact didn't have enough funds to create an extraordinary one. So in 1895, the three came together and created the Astor, Lenox, and Tilden Foundation, which was really the essential foundation for what we now know as the New York Public Library.
But John Jacob Astor was dead by then. He had left money for the creation of a free public library in 1848, and that was the first in the United States, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And, I think New York has a lot to be proud of in that many folks who lived here had that philanthropic notion of making books available and accessible.
Although you couldn't take the books out. It was not a circulating library.
That's correct. But to be fair, the current New York Public Library flagship station also is not only the children's room is a circulating library, but the rest of the library has a similar spirit.
Now, I've always been told that Andrew Carnegie was the source of the American free library system, but he's a latecomer, isn't he?
I think it was, that's early 20th century, and his contributions were really nationwide. Mm-hmm. So many of the New York Public Library branch libraries are Carnegie libraries, but he also, they were expressed in Massachusetts, they were expressed in Pennsylvania. So in terms of, real estate, he did a lot in terms of branch libraries, circulating libraries, community-based libraries.
Were the Astor and Lenox libraries open to the general public?
So I don't want to get my facts incorrect. One of them was accessible to the public and one was more private. But once the foundation came together, the notion was to have a library that was accessible to all.
And then the decision was to put it on Fifth Avenue and 42nd Street. Not a bad site. Why was that chosen for the main branch? What was there before?
Actually, great question. It was the site of the Croton Reservoir. So what an opportunity, if you just think about it from a poetic and symbolic standpoint, that here the notion of water flowing from upstate New York to feed and nourish New Yorkers now becomes the site of this major library.
There was no Bryant Park then, I imagine.
There was no Bryant Park then, but, I don't want to get my facts incorrect, but I think soon after that property was created.
Well, how much activity was there in this area? New York, for much of its history, was downtown.
That's correct. So, it's so fabulous to think about the transformation of, the grid from, the village, which had winding streets and streets on which you could get lost, to the numbered maps, et cetera. So, above 14th Street was kind of the second chapter of New York City history, and it was still a developing and evolving space. So it's nothing as what we think today of Midtown and the kind of packed populations that existed there. But there was a vision that would be a grand place, because remember, between on either side of the New York Public Library, you had Penn Station to the west and Grand Central Station to the east.
So, and they were already there.
They were already there, yes.
Was there any concern about the fact that this was being built over a former reservoir? I would think that putting books in a space that had so much water underneath it might not be the best idea.
It's a really good question, but my guess is that the architects and the engineers gave a lot of thought to that question before they pursued.
And the architects were Carrera and Hastings, famous architects. How did they get the commission? Was there a competition?
There was a competition, and I think what happened is John Shaw Billings was named the director before the kind of the plant was even established. And the lore has it that he drew his vision on a napkin. And the core of that vision was that the main reading room would be in an elevated space off the mundane streets that pedestrians walked every day. So that really kind of defined what he wanted to see happen at this library. But I also think that part of his vision was that it would be a brick building. Thanks to the competition and Carrera and Hastings' background in Beaux-Arts architecture. They'd both been at the École des Beaux-Arts. They both were draftspeople for McKim, Mead, and White. And therefore, marble was kind of front row and center.
And did this make the firm's reputation?
You know, it's a great question. I think that it certainly crystallized their reputation, you know, in New York. They had created buildings previously, many of which actually have been raised over the years. So, for example, they had done the interior of the Met Opera, which no longer exists. One of the buildings that still stands, which I've only learned about recently and see somewhat of a comparison with the New York Public Library, is the Lunt Fontaine Theater on West 46th Street.
Well, the old Metropolitan Opera, which was on Broadway, I think between 40th and 39th Street, was one of the great buildings of New York, lost only because it was so hard to move stuff in and out of it.
I didn't know that was why.
Were the Lions there from the start?
The Lions were there from the start. And what's interesting is that they were created from Tennessee marble. Marble features really, really largely, not only in the building, but in a lot of these other ornamental elements. So created with Tennessee marble are considered, I think they're twice as large or three times as large as actual lions would be. And I think one of the great anecdotal tales is that Fiorello LaGuardia, during one of his speeches during the Depression, named them Patience and Fortitude. Patience is the lion to the south, fortitude to the north, as a way to inspire New Yorkers to think about the potential strong future of New York City.
Why is the New York Public Library only in Manhattan, the Bronx, and Staten Island? Brooklyn has its own. Queens has its own. I would have thought, I understand the Brooklyn, because it was a separate city until 1900 or so. But I would have thought that the library systems would have been integrated.
You're not the only one. In fact, many people still are not aware that there are three separate branch. These are the branch library systems we're talking about. This goes back to it does go back to the history of the incorporation of the city and these three different systems. I think over the years, especially in tough economic times, there's been a consideration of what would it be to combine all of these libraries. But to your point, the Bronx, Manhattan, Staten Island, and we have 87 branch libraries.
My guest is Elaine Chernoff, Director of Education Programming and Exhibitions at the New York Public Library, which is celebrating its centennial, at least the main branch, which started the whole thing. And what was in the initial collection? Was it just books? Because the exhibit you have now covers a wide range of things, even locks of hair.
Largely books. Interesting, a lot of Russian materials, you know, manuscripts, photographs from the beginning. It was very, I don't want to call it haphazard. There were thoughtful staff people. Ultimately, those titles became curator. But thoughtful staff who were really trying to accumulate what's the hallmark of the library's approach, which is bringing really democratic values to collecting the whole range of human experience, largely through print.
We have a slideshow of images from the exhibit, including Charles Dickens' infamous letter opener on our show page at WNYC.org. There are, I gather, 88 miles of stacks of books. Where are they located? Underneath the building?
Underneath the building. Really, again, thoughtful architectural innovation because not always easy to build up when you don't have the steel, et cetera. So there are 12 floors of stacks underneath the library that also extend into Bryant Park.
And you have the collection itself has more than 50 million items. How much of it was donated?
You know, again, I can't speak with authority. I'd say it's a real blend of donation and of acquisition through private dollars. I think that's the thing that a lot of the public isn't always aware of in what it looks like to have a research library, what portions, you know, are our taxpayer dollars going for these kind of collections. In fairness, these are dollars that are these are private dollars to acquire these collections.
So if the library, something becomes available and the library feels that it will fill a need, it goes out to people who have supported it in the past and says, can you give us some money to buy this thing? The same as museums will
That's correct. But it is true that celebrated writers and authors and creators also do make donations.
The collection, as I said, contains more than 50 million items. The exhibit has 250.
Painful. It was painful.
And you've organized it into four sections: observation, contemplation, creativity, and society. Why those four?
You know, exhibitions need organizing principles to help the public navigate this massive material. And to your point, how do you distill 50 million objects and items into a narrative? So these were broad-reaching organizing principles that can incorporate a whole range of material that the public, which is who we're trying to communicate to, can start to wrap their head around around that range and around the depth.
What's the oldest piece in the exhibit?
It's actually the first piece on exhibit, which are some of the Sumerian cuneiform.
And there's also a Gutenberg Bible.
Yes, there is.
And how many Gutenberg Bibles exist?
I think it's less than 10, we are privileged to have one of them. And in fact, these two items that you just make reference to are in the beginning sections of the exhibition, which is really a way to help folks understand how information has been recorded and shared over time from the earliest cuneiform to the present, which is the New York Public Library's digital gallery.
There's a scroll of the Tale of Genji dated 1580. That's a book that was written around 1020, so the scroll was created over a half century after the book was written by Lady Murasaki.
Exactly. And the thing that I think is so remarkable when you wander and spend time in the exhibition is appreciating that these works, which are hundreds, in some cases thousands of years old, have been so well preserved. In some cases, we can see a magazine on the street as we walk down Fifth Avenue that looks very old, and you see these works and the colors and the richness are as if they were just created yesterday.
Well, because they've been treasured, I'd assume. You have an illustrated manuscript of St. Augustine's The City of God from the 15th century, the first folio of King Lear from 1608. Must be very fragile. Also, the Declaration of Independence in Thomas Jefferson's own hand.
Exactly.
How rare are these things?
To say the least, very rare. I mean, I don't know. We're not in a position to focus on, like, what is the dollar value, but easy enough to say, you know, priceless. And I think one of the other aspects about the library that's so cool is that, you know, there's a whole division that's devoted to the conservation and preservation of these materials, and they are working with kind of state-of-the-art scientific technique, state-of-the-art facilities to make sure that these items are both protected, preserved. But the one another cool thing about the library, in contrast to museums, is that they're also made accessible.
There are dime novels and dance cards, so I'm assuming that you decided to include anything that might be considered intrinsic to the culture of any particular time.
So again, it's the effort of the exhibition is really to illustrate that whole range from, you know, high culture, important political and historical documents, to the artistic culture and expression, which is so central not only to New York but to the globe.
And there are a number of items illustrating the writing process. There's a manuscript by Jorge Luis Borges, a draft of Native Son by Richard Wright, George Eliot's notebooks for Daniel Deronda, wow, and a manuscript of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland with, quote, amendments by Ezra Pound.
Pretty amazing.
So Pound went over it and said, Tom, I suggest you change this line.
Exactly. And so one of the other extraordinary, there's subsection of what exists within the library. You know, there's a whole division of the library that's dedicated to what's called marginalia. So that if you're a scholar or an academic or just a curious person who's impassioned by a certain author, you can see the way they themselves or others have been responding to their first draft, their third draft.
There's a group of typewriters used by E. Cummings, Terry Southern, S.J. Perlman. And the day I was there, a young boy asked his mother, is that what people use before computers?
I know. We all have a lot to learn. To learn both about history.
Well, this collection is becoming more historic by the moment. And then there are artworks, self-portraits by Rembrandt, Diego Rivera, Chuck Close, Kiki Smith. There's Leon Bach's costume designs for the Ballet Russe. There are artist books by Matisse, Giacometti, Miro, a world atlas by Maya Lin. Why are they in a library rather than in a museum?
Again, because I think the practice of collecting was considered so wide-ranging. And the difference, again, between the library and the museum is that these books will be made accessible. If you want to get your card for the research library and make an appointment with one of the curators, it is for you to – you can look at it. You can touch it. So it's a very different practice from museum collecting.
I don't know if I want to touch Charles Dickens' letter opener. The handle was made from his cat Bob's paw.
Yes, which apparently was not so atypical a practice, but he loved his cat, and Bob gave him pleasure during the cat's life and after his life.
So after he died, he made okay. They also have Virginia Woolf's diary from 1941 and her walking stick, which her husband Leonard found floating in the river after she committed suicide.
So, in fact, that section is a very moving one. That's in the contemplation section. And the diary, it's open to her last entry, which was 4 days before she committed suicide. So you look at that alongside the object, her walking stick. And, you know, objects often, you know, they're imbued with the history and the spirit of an individual. So those juxtapositions of written word and things, I think, really have deep meaning.
Because we're not just getting the notebooks. The same with these personal items that belong to Jack Kerouac. There was a notebook, but also a pipe, eyeglasses, a harmonica, a box of Valium.
Yeah.
And a pair of crutches?
Yeah, so that's a particularly popular section. I guess folks must be, especially younger people, must be reading Kerouac or Beat artists in school again. And a lot of people convene around that section.
And then we have a briefcase, a journal, and a Quran that belong to Malcolm X. So there's a wide range of things. Handwritten scores by Beethoven and John Coltrane. Do they belong to the Performing Arts Library at Lincoln Center?
Yeah, they do. And you bring up a good point here, which I'd like to elucidate. So the exhibition is celebrating the Stephen A. Schwarzman Building, 42nd Street, 5th Avenue. But in fact, the Science Industry and Business Library and the Library of Performing Arts were extensions of the original 42nd Street Library. In fairness, the fourth research library of the New York Public Library, the Schomburg Center, was always a separate entity, but we wanted to be all-inclusive in showcasing all the riches of the research libraries.
Has the library's collection changed much since the advent of the Internet?
So it's changed in how we are trying to communicate and how we're doing some of our own research. I'll give two specific examples. So 740,000 images from the collections have now been digitized, and anyone, night or day, anywhere in the globe can access these images.
Does Google know about this?
They're very aware of this. They call us all the time. So fabulous, fabulous materials that you can call through, get inspiration. So that's one piece of it. Another piece of it with regard to what are we doing with our collections, you know, in 2011. So we have one of the most amazing cookbook and menu collections. And part of our menu collections, they're hard to research currently because they're just individual handwritten menus from New York and other areas starting in the 1800s. Well, we now have what's called a crowdsourcing project where we're inviting the public to help translate these menus from script into kind of computer language so that we can start to map how much were oysters over the course of a century, where were they sold, what kind of cuisine was most popular in what section of town. So we're really relying on kind of citizen engagement meets new technology to help reveal more and more of the library's collections.
And as I said, there's an exhibit of the of some highlights from the collection, but on top of it, you're also celebrating the 100th anniversary with a book from Penguin Classics called Know the Past, Find the Future. What's in that?
So what's in that are 100 luminaries, if you get the symbolism, 100 years, 100 luminaries, who we invited to come into any of the four research libraries and choose an object or a manuscript that had meaning for them. And they wrote very brief entries. So we have a photograph of them along with the object and their brief story. And on the weekend and week of the centennial, which was May 23, we had massive distribution all across the city, outside of subway systems, outside of schools, et cetera, and shared. We have 20,000 of these works circulating free. And the notion, trying to keep the spirit of library, is that we hope people read it and they pass it along.
It is revealing to see what some people chose. Maya Bloomberg chose the children's book, Johnny Tremaine.
Yeah.
I can't remember that book anymore. Stephen Colbert chose J.D. Salinger's Letters, Laurie Anderson, The Declaration of Independence. I'm not surprised that Gabriel Byrne chose a portrait of James Joyce from Bernice Abbott. Do you have any favorites if you were contributing to this book?
If I was contributing to this book, oh, that's a great question. You know, I think I'm still pretty new to the library, so I'm still in that wow phase. And I imagine 20 years from now, if I'm there, I'm going to still say that. But I've always been a big fan, I'll tell you, of Maya Lin and her work. And one of the objects actually in the exhibition, I think, is pretty extraordinary. So you made reference to it earlier, where she essentially takes a world atlas and uses her imagination and technique to cut it out in a topographical manner. So it has kind of an architectural and sculptural quality to it. And it's such a simple premise, but it's transformative. And that might be one I chose not so much for it's my area of expertise or particular area of passion, but for the appreciation of how artists and architects are always maybe it's called mashup, you know, repurposing and playing with previously existing materials and objects.
How have the recent city budget cuts affected the library? There were concerns that some branches might have to be closed 3 days a week. Has that been avoided?
Well, I have to say we got some really, really wonderful news at the end of the going into this fiscal year. There had been a proposed $40 million cut, and the New York Public Libraries only experienced a $3 million cut. So while that's still, you know, those are deep, but it's not as catastrophic as had been imagined. And again, we had a lot of advocacy work through staff members and our government relations division, but we really, really have to thank the New York City public for speaking out and identifying that public libraries are as important as so many of the other major resources, whether you think of hospitals and firehouses, et cetera. So it's they're critically important to keeping communities bound and thinking and working together.
The exhibit we've been talking about, celebrating 100 years, runs through December 31st, so you're actually celebrating the whole year with this exhibit.
Yeah, we really want the public to experience it, and also remember, this is a free exhibition. It's accessible by just walking up the steps of 42nd Street.
And I thank Elaine Charnoff, who's Director of Education Programming and Exhibitions at the New York Public Library, for being with us today. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much.